Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harrah's and the poker coach, Joe McGowan. Brought to you by Poker Stars, Reactor Watches, and the Poker Players Alliance.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
You got it.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Jackpot. Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Full tables of poker action and a $153,000 bed beat that some players are eyeing and drooling over. I am Paul Harrah's. Welcome to St. Louis. In the Harrah's World Series of Poker Poker Room, my partner Dennis Phillips is not here today. He is in Monte Carlo playing in the European Poker Tour big finale. Dennis is joining us today live via phone from there. How are you doing, buddy?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. Fighting a little bit of a cough. If I cough in your ear, I apologize.
That's all right. Must be that volcanic ash.
It's something. There's a lot of people coughing around here a little bit, so who knows?
You, speaking of volcanic ash, you almost didn't make it there. Last week we were joking on the show that a couple days before you were going to be flying that you might not be able to go at all, and then you finally did go, but it was a tight squeeze, right?
Oh, absolutely. All I did was miss four flights, and my luggage showed up 24 hours late.
And you had to fly from St. Louis to Chicago, where you had to do like an O.J. Simpson sprint through the airport, right?
Oh, I have to. I have to actually give some good kudos to American Airlines. They knew it was going to be super tight. They called to the gate ahead of time to see if they could wait on me for a few minutes. And they put one of those little mini trams or carts or whatever there, and they picked me up from the one gate and basically sped me over to the other one. It's the first time I've ever ridden with them through the airport. They could spoil you.
Plus, you get that annoying beep, beep, get out of the way sound, so everybody knows who's on the
court. Oh, yeah. I got some real dirty stares from people, let me tell you. They wanted to hop on, I think.
I bet. So you said your luggage didn't get there with you, huh?
No, not even close. It ended up in Chicago, and that's as far as it made it. And then about a day and a half later, it finally showed up here. I was threatening everybody. I was wondering what the laws in Europe were, what happens when I go naked walking around. And they said probably nothing.
Forget about the laws of Europe. How about the laws of nature?
Good point. Can you imagine? Now, let's not even go there. Not even go there.
So the fact that you had such a tough time getting there, did that impact other players who were headed for the EPT?
There is a number that did not make it here. We ended up with over 800 for the main event. Last year was over 900. And I truly think they would have at least matched, if not top, last year if they'd had the weather hadn't. And the volcanic ash had not come into play.
One of the good things was probably that so many of them were already at San Remo in Italy for the previous EPT event, right?
This is true. Plus, there's lots of other things. A number of them came over from England by the Channel, came under the sea.
Uh-huh.
20-hour bus ride to make it here.
Wow.
But, you know, they're here.
Yeah. Well, let me just promote what we got coming up on the show today. Paul Wasica, who was the runner-up to Jamie Gold at the 2006 main event of the World Series of Poker, will be here the following year, by the way. After that, he won the Heads Up Poker Championship on NBC and was here just about a week and a half ago at Harrah's St. Louis when we had the main event of the circuit event that took place here. So we'll talk to him about that and lots of other things he's involved in. Speaking of the NBC Heads Up, the poker coach Joe McGowan got a chance to talk to Andy Block and Gus Hansen during that event, and we'll share that audio with you. And we finally got to see you for a few minutes on the Heads Up on NBC this past Sunday, where you took out your first round challenger, Kara Scott. She was a guest on our show shortly after you guys actually taped that event at Caesars. But we finally got a chance to see you, and really all we saw was your final hand, where I think you had pocket eights and she had king queen, right?
Yeah. It was basically a race.
Yep. Ali Najad had a very funny line on the telecast after you knocked her out. He said, on behalf of the deck, I'd like to apologize to the 18 to 34 demographic.
Yeah, well, that's about right. Got a chance for people cheering for her for that reason.
Yeah, well, we know you're going to be on there for a few more weeks because we've announced on this show that you finished third after getting knocked out of there by Annie Duke, who was the eventual winner. But we'll see more of you in the coming weeks on the Heads Up. Now let's talk about what's going on there in Monte Carlo. The main event started on Sunday, and unfortunately for you, it also ended on Sunday.
Yeah, I made it through the very last hand of level six. As everybody's getting ready to go for supper, I decided I needed a longer break, I guess. It was a rather tough day.
Any hands you want to talk about?
Actually, there's about three hands I'd like to talk about. I'd like to get your opinion on them. I've talked to Chris Moneymaker and a couple other guys over here about them. I'd love to hear from some of the people about what they thought and how I should have played them in that.
Okay.
So, right. First hand. And by the way, I lost all three of these to the same gentleman. A guy by the name of Chris Born. It's like D-J-O-R-N.
Uh-huh.
He's been playing poker for 20-some, maybe 30 years. A little over 60 years old. Great guy, by the way. Solid, solid player. I think he says he has over 50 caches in different WSOP events.
Wow.
So, yeah, and he pretty much cleaned me out. Took him three hands. I had built my stack up to a little over 70,000. The average at the time this hand took place was about 38, 39. So I had almost double the chip average.
What did you start with?
30,000.
Okay.
Yeah, we're through a couple of levels. Maybe we're in the we're farther than that. We're through about four levels, but just started where people are starting to drop off. You know, the first couple of levels you don't lose very many. That deep of starting stack and the blinds are being fairly small.
Yep.
Anyhow, I'm in the big blind. I look down at kings. There's a short stack immediately under the gun. He has ballpark about 6,600 chips. He raises it to 1,200. The blinds are 2 and 4 at this time on it. So he just makes normal 3X.
Yep.
Chris, who is the chip leader at the table, makes it 3,000. Now then, I'm looking at the guy. He's short enough stacked. My thought is that he's going to shove because, you know, otherwise he's calling off basically 50% of his hand, 47, 48% of his chips, somewhere in that range. So, and it's enough of a raise that then I can re-raise it. So I just smooth called the 3,000. And, of course, nothing works out. He smooth called.
So was your thinking there that if you had 4-bet after Chris had 3-bet, that the under-the-gun guy who was short stack would go away and those would be some valuable chips that you wouldn't be able to get your hands on?
No, not at all. I didn't think there's any way in the world he's folding this hand. He's got... You know, he raised under the gun to 12. He's got what he thinks is a premium hand. I don't think he's going away. You know, for him to put 1,200 out of that into it, and he's a fairly tight player, no. He wanted to see this one out. I think if I shove there, he would, go all in. He would try and call me, no problem at all.
Yep.
And we would be heads up. My thought is that if I just smooth call, again, he makes it to 6,600. Which is a little over a $3,000 raise. Chris down there can do whatever. He can re-raise or just smooth call. What didn't make any difference when it comes back to me, I shove. And unless Chris has aces, he's probably going to lay it down.
Okay.
Then I have heads up for the other gentleman.
Okay.
And Chris's money's in the pot dead.
All right. Before you go on to what happens on the flop, I think in that circumstance I might 4-bet to get isolated against the short stack if I'm 100% confident that he's going to put his chips in. And I think that Chris might have 3-bet with even ace-king or ace-queen. I'd like to...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'd like to get him out of there and, let me isolate against the under-the-gun short stack. And I think I probably would have made a big raise there to, maybe 10,000 or more.
Well, and there's nothing wrong with that, and that would have isolated it. Chris would have probably laid it down. I was trying to get some more Chris's money, to be honest, before I pushed him out.
Okay.
As long as, because a normal move there, when you have that many, that it's going to be that much of a percentage of your chips is to shove, not to just call. Why would you call half your chips, basically, out there? You either fold or shove in that position, in my opinion.
Okay, so you check, and now the under the gun, the original raiser, checks behind you, and so you go three-handed to the flop.
Yeah, with a decent amount out there. I mean, there's each of us have 3,000 in, plus the others, there's close to 10,000 in the pot.
Okay.
So So again, the guy only has a little over 3,000 left. He's not going anywhere, you would assume. Flop is an ace, queen, rag, like a six on it.
You hate that ace.
Ace when you have the pocket. Absolutely. So I checked. Small blind, or the guy that was under the gun to start with, shoves, which I knew he would. Now this is the response. Chris shoves behind him.
Wow.
So it's my tournament life if I do anything there. So, I mean, it's very simple to throw the kings away.
One of these guys, 100%, one of these guys.
Under the gun turns over ace queen. Chris turns over ace queen.
They both had ace queen,
and they chop it. The way the hand played out, I think I lost the minimum there. If I'd have done what, like you said, granted, Chris would have folded, but I would have lost to the other guy and lost another 3,000 chips. I don't know whether it's the right move or not. I'm kind of curious. I'd love to hear what the viewers think about that. As it turned out, since the guy did not shove, I ended up losing the minimum. So maybe I misplayed it, but lost less because of it.
Well, like I said, if we had played it the way I said, you're right. I probably would have lost another 3,000 or 4,000 chips, whatever it was, for the short stack to
right.
go all in. But you did end up losing the minimum, and you know, you didn't get into a battle with Chris. And by the way, you know, I don't know what kind of player he is, but if he's the kind of guy who would have called your raise to 10,000 pre-flop,
yeah.
Now you're losing even more chips. So,
oh yeah, absolutely.
So you got dinged up there, but did you say when the hand started you had about 70K?
Yes.
All right,
what
so,
I had on.
All right, so you lost 3,000 out of 70. That's not a horrible exactly. hit to your hand. What's the next hand?
Yeah, no. I went on a couple more rounds. I think at this time I'm starting up the hand. I have somewhere 64,000 left in front of me.
Okay.
I look down at pocket fours. Gentleman to my right, 3Xs it to start out. I just smooth call it. Again, it's 2 and 4 on the blind, so he makes it 1,200. I call the 1,200, goes all the way around to Chris, who this time is in the big blind. He calls the 1,200 on that. So it's three-handed to the flop. Flop is a deuce, 4, 5. So I flop middle set.
Mm-hmm.
All righty. It's a check and a check, and I checked. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely no action on the flop.
Mm-hmm.
Turn comes a jack. Check and check again. At this time, I'm assuming that they both have squadouche, you know, maybe an ace-queen for the guy that did the initial one, whatever, but I have to get some money in the pot.
Yep.
So, again, there's 3,900 with the Andes and such in there. So I make it 2,700.
Okay.
Chris smooth calls.
Smooth calls.
The other gentleman folds, and probably he did have like ace-queen, ace-king, who knows what, but he had nothing of what was out there.
Yep.
Chris's smooth call worries me, but, you know, who knows for sure.
What do you put him on at this point?
At that time, honestly, he was in the big blind. He's capable of playing a wide variety of hands. What I'm hoping is he had, you know, like a pair of deuces, but I'm assuming he has an overpair at this time of some sort onto it. Again, I think it was about a 10-high board. He could have had jacks and just smooth called out of position with two of us in there rather than re-raising. He could have done a lot of different things there on it.
Well, on a board of jack, 5, 4, 2, if he's calling there, I might put him on a middle pair, like eights or nines, but more likely I'd probably
sure.
put him on ace-jack.
Again, no problem at all with that, except I think it was a 10 instead of a jack. I think I told you wrong. I believe
okay.
it was a 10-high board instead of a jack-high.
Okay.
But irrelevant. It could be an ace-10 there for sure. Lots of little things. I figured the best hand he had at this time was a pocket jacks that he didn't want to play a huge hand with because he was already the chip leader at
okay.
the table. But irregardless, another rag comes out on the river. There is no flush. There is no straight. Nothing like that. He bets 6,500.
Well, there is a straight on the board. You got the.
Sorry.
You said the flop
absolutely
was 2, 4,
right.
5, so there's the possibility of a straight.
Absolutely is. You're absolutely right. I go into the tank for about 5 minutes with the fours. I'm not for sure. I mean, I know I can't lay them down. I want to re-raise, but him smooth calling and then leading out with a 6,500, you know, I'm not for sure what he has. He's scaring me with it a little bit. It's possible he had pocket fives and he has, if we did set over set, I mean, I don't know for sure on it, so I just smooth called him.
Or it's possible.
Three of hearts. flopped the straight.
He had ace three. He did have the straight. Wow.
Did have the straight on it. Again, I got kudos from everybody at the table for losing the minimum there. The one guy said I would have been broke on it because I'd have been shoving with my fours. I went, well, no, not a chance in the world of that. But irregardless, you know, between the turn bet and the river bet, I lost, you know, 10,000. I'm all the way down to just a little over 50,000 now.
Okay. Now, before we go on to the third hand, I know some of our listeners are going to be thinking, well, you might have avoided this problem if you had raised pre-flop with your pair of fours.
Sure.
After the first guy raised, if you had three bet him, Chris is probably not going to be calling in the big blind with ace three.
Correct. But the problem with that, and I should have explained it earlier, it was as a younger internet-type guy, he could have played like a Scott Montgomery right there. And literally, I make the raise with the fours, he comes back over the top on me. And at that time, I'm not for sure I would have called for, you know, 20,000 with pocket fours.
Yep. Plus the other problem with that,
and I have
the problem with raising with all small pairs pre-flop is those hands play best in a multi-way pot. They play worst in a heads-up pot. So you actually want the small blind and Chris in the big blind to call there, because now you're going to be able to do something. If your four does hit, there's your bingo card, and you can make some money with it. It just turned out to be exactly
right.
The opposite in this case, right?
Oh, absolutely, on it. Again, you know, I could have played it several different ways, could have raised pre-flop, could have done a lot of things, but I'm not for sure. And Chris might have laid down to a big raise. This is true. But the guy also then might have shoved on me, the initial raiser, especially if he had ace-king. He would have shoved with ace-king there, I'm almost positive.
Okay.
I would have had to lay down my fours.
Yeah. Let's go to your third hand.
Yeah, third hand was, and again, I'm now down to around 50,000. That's all I have left on it. Comes out there, I look down at pocket kings. You know, this is my hand. Maybe I can get back up to 70, something like that. Let's see what the heck happens on this on it there. I am the big blind again, right? Not the gentleman that raised last time, but the one next to him, between him and Chris, raises it. This time the blinds had gone up. They were three and six. He makes it 1,500. All righty. Chris just smooth calls with the 1,500. Comes back around to me. I raise it to 5,000 with my kings.
Now you are trying to isolate. Now you are trying to isolate.
Go ahead. I'm sorry?
Now you are trying to isolate, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. With the stack that the other guy has, he has to either, in my opinion, shove or fold. He doesn't have any option. He can't just smooth call me. Chris has enough. He can do a lot of different options with it. But he only has, you know, about 1,500 in the pot. It's an easy laydown for him with almost any hand on it. Well, again, the initial raiser folds. Chris shoves.
Oh.
I went into the tank for I don't know how long. Again, he's got 80,000 this time. So he's got me well covered. I've already got a decent amount of my chips in there. Pre-flop with the kings, I'm not a good enough player to lay down there. I went ahead and I called him. I went all in. He turned over the pocket aces. What was really nasty was the flop with an ace-king-10.
Oh.
So, you know. But
what a cool
C'est la vie, as they say.
Wow. Now, in that situation, when you're thinking about whether you're going to make the call pre-flop, you're thinking to yourself, well, this guy over here raised, and he only smooth called. Would he really have smooth called with aces, right?
Yeah, exactly. I honestly thought he was trying to isolate and get me out of the pot. That's what I finally decided, and he had jacks or queens or ace-king, whatever, and he wanted to play against the small, and he didn't want me seeing a flop.
Wow.
So, you know, didn't quite work that way. And he said actually that's what he was. He wanted me out of the pot. He wanted to go heads up with a guy. The pot was big enough. Well, but unfortunately he had aces.
Mm. So there's the end of your day. So, six levels into the main event of the EPT Monte Carlo.
But the nice thing about it, Chris took me out to supper at a very, very nice restaurant. And he was in somewhere around 7th or 8th place in the tournament because of my contributions to him.
Gee, that's nice of him to take you out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, so much.
So he's still playing in this event that you got knocked out of on Sunday. That was day 1B when you played, and I guess they're up to day 3 today. Is he still in there with your chips?
He's still in it, yes. It's actually day 2. I played 1A, they had 1B, and now they're playing 2A, just 2 on it. And he's still in. I'm not for sure what his chip count is because I'm playing in a 5K now, so I'm kind of preoccupied. But, he had a good chip count, and I know he's still in.
You're in a 5K right now?
Correct. So what am I doing talking to you on the phone, right?
Well, then I'll only keep you for a few more minutes before I get to our guest, Paul Wasika. Actually, before we talk about anything else, let's talk about PokerStars, sponsor of our show. They're the ones putting on this this big event there, the EPT. And have they made the announcement about the other two NAPT events for this year?
They have not. I do have the information on that, and they're hoping to announce it later this week. But so far, they have not announced that. They've actually got 3 or 4 announcements. We had several meetings over here that we went through some things. I'm kind of excited about it. This company is just a phenomenal, the way they're growing and the way they take care of their players. It's just unreal.
I was online last night playing a little bit on PokerStars in the Steps program because I'd like to be able to try to win my way into the main event of the World Series this summer if I can. And I've worked my way up to step number 4, and I'll take more shots at it later on today. But I also just kind of browsed through all the different satellites they've got for all of these different events. From the World Series of Poker main event to whatever comes up next on the NAPT to future events on the EPT and the Scoop, which is the next big thing for PokerStars, right?
The Scoop is just absolutely phenomenal. A variety of different games, a variety of different levels, some huge prize pools on this. I'll be playing a lot of them. I think it starts in 5 days. I intend to play a lot of poker on PokerStars in the next 2 weeks.
If you want to get in on it, you can go to PokerStars.net, download the software, play all of these events as free rolls online, and maybe end up, people always tell me they're really jealous of you because they'd love to be able to travel on somebody else's dime and play a lot of poker, and this is their chance.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a phenomenal chance on it, some great prizes there. I'm itching for it.
Before I let you go, let's talk a little bit about your PokerStars colleague, Daniel Negreanu, whose horrible run on high-stakes poker continued on Sunday night. I know you didn't get a chance to see it because you were in Monte Carlo, but there were a couple of brutal hands between Daniel and the mouth, Mike Mattisau. And I just want to go over a couple of these and get your thoughts on them. Since we analyzed your play, let's do a little analysis of Daniel's play here, okay?
Sounds good.
All right. There's one hand where Mattisau raised to 6,000 with ace-queen offsuit. He gets 6 callers. He misses the flop, and he ends up throwing it away. And then on the very next hand, Mattisau is under the gun and raises with 2 kings. I'm sorry, he doesn't raise. He limps for $800 after having raised the previous hand with ace-queen offsuit. Now he limps for $800. Daniel calls with the 9-8 of clubs. Ellie Elezra raises it up to 5K with the ace of diamonds and the 7 of hearts. Mattisau, with his kings, just smooth calls with his, in that situation, which seemed odd to me. And, of course, Daniel calls behind him. Now, the best part of this hand is coming up right now, the flop. King, 9-9. Mattisau.
Oh, my God, what a cooler.
Mattisau flops the full. And Daniel has flopped a set of nines or trip nines. So Mike, with the full checks there, he hasn't shown any strength in this hand, so why show it off now? He checks. Daniel checks because they know that Ellie is going to continue, and he does. He throws out a continuation bet of 8,800, which is about half the pot there. Mike smooth calls.
Yep.
And now Daniel, with his trip nines, raises to 28,800. Ellie folds, and Mike, 3 bets now, to 68,800. Daniel goes into the tank for 30 seconds before shoving all in. And, of course, Mike calls. And they run it twice, which is, you know, nice of Mike to do that. But they're both blanks. The case 9 doesn't come out. And Mike wins a $329,000 pot. And we're talking cash here because it is high-stakes poker. The question here is, why does Daniel shove on the turn?
Wow. I mean, you have no idea. It should have been a little suspicious, the smooth calls from Mike. Wow. I'm not for sure, to be honest about it. With an 8 kicker, man.
You know, I can see him doing that if he's got ace 9. But with 8-9 in your hand, Mattisau could have 10-9 and you're beat. Jack-9, queen-9,
that's what I mean.
King-9, any of which are, by the way, hands that he would have just limped pre-flop, and now he's coming along for the ride. Why make that call? There's virtually no hand. I mean, unless you're putting Mattisau on a stone-cold bluff here, what can you beat?
Yeah, very, very little. An overpair is the only thing you can beat.
Now later they get it all in again.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. There's a six-way hand. It's six ways on a straddle, and it comes around to Daniel, and now he's got a pair of tens. Now the straddle is the 1600, so six people are already in. So there's almost 10,000 in the pot. He makes it 16,000 with his pair of tens. It comes back around. But now it comes back around to Mattisau, who's got the ace of clubs and the queen of clubs. He probably is thinking that Daniel's on a steal. He makes it 45K. Daniel calls. The flop comes out 7-6-4 with two clubs. Mattisau is first to act, and he shoves. And Daniel, with his pair of tens, cry calls. Now, what's going on there?
Again, I'm sorry about the coughing here. What the heck?
I know.
I mean, was this soon after the other hand? Mike sometimes, and I'll have to admit this, he gets a deep stack in front of him. Sometimes he goes a little nuts.
Well, he wasn't.
You know, tries to pull at the table and everything like that.
Believe it or not, Mike the Mouth Mattisau was the nittiest player at the table. He had not played a hand like in the first hour of the show, and then in the second episode, and again, we're talking about edited time here, but he was not playing any hands. In fact, other players were making fun of him for not playing any hands. He was a total nit at the table. There's no reason for Daniel to think that Mike is making a move there, except that he has the history with Mike going back for 15 years, and maybe that's what was influencing his decision.
Well, I guarantee it almost had to be. I can think of no other justification for it. Because I can lay tens down there with ease. You know, if you flop third set, you know, fine and dandy. You got an overpair, fine and dandy. I mean, tens? Oh my gosh! What is he putting on? Just a bluff again?
I guess.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't understand that one at all.
Here's the sick part: they agree to run it twice. Mike hits a club both times. Scoops a $496,000 pot. That after taking a $329,000 pot from Daniel.
Daniel's down half a million.
Daniel's down half a million, or $420,000 between those two pots. Just horrible. His, you know, six seasons in a row he's been getting his butt kicked. It's just sick. All right, one last thing. Because the Poker Players Alliance is a big sponsor of our show, I hear from a source that they are going to be marking up Congressman Jim McDermott's bill this week. This is the one that would repeal the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act, which is set to go into effect on June 1st. And it is the first bill that I've heard of, Dennis, that would set up taxes and regulation on online poker. McDermott says, people have said we want to be legal and we're certainly willing to pay taxes. Well, we need the money, so this is a net positive. So I wanted your reaction to this bill. He would call for the bill calls for a 6% tax on all deposits. So if you are, for instance, living here in Missouri and you put $1,000 into an online gambling account anywhere in the country, $60 would go to Missouri's state government and then there'd be another 2% of those deposits that would go to the federal government. So 8% of whatever you deposit would count as taxes, and I guess that would come off the top of your deposit. My question for you, since you are staying informed on a lot of these things with your friends there at PokerStars, is let's say somebody goes and makes a $1,000 deposit on PokerStars once everything is legal, and the government takes $80 out of that. Is PokerStars going to make up the $80?
No. I mean, there's you need to pay for the regulations, for the safety, for everything else that's going on here. We have no problem paying the taxes on it. PokerStars is not. It's going to still be a level playing field. Everybody would end up having to pay the taxes. Now, then, remember, it's up to you, and it's your responsibility to keep track of your wins and losses. If you end up winning anyhow, if you weren't paying taxes, you would have to pay taxes on the winnings. If you lose that $1,000, you can claim that on your income tax and get the $80 back. So, no, I have no problem with the tax. And they're just taking the taxes out in front and putting the burden back on the players to try and claim and to file for that.
But I guess the question would be, is would the players be the one losing $80 out of their deposit? Or would the player instead get full $1,000 credit on PokerStars or one of the other sites, and the site would pay those taxes?
Oh, I don't think there's any way the site's going to pay the taxes on it. That's actually a good question. The people are here, all the hierarchy of PokerStars, and I will talk to them tomorrow to find out. But I'm guessing that no, the site would not pay the taxes. That is a guess.
Look into that and talk to them, because they're supposedly marking up this bill, if not this week, probably sometime next week. And it goes along with the Barney Frank bill and, of course, the one in the Senate that Bob Menendez has been working on. And, you know, we're only about 5 or 6 weeks away from that UIGEA deadline. And let's find out where we stand on all of this and have an update next week, okay?
I will do that with ease. Like I said, the hierarchy of PokerStars is over here. I've already had a meeting with several of them. I've talked to Esai himself. I'll find out the answer to that and report back next week.
Great. Okay, get back to your 5K tournament. I hope you don't run into as many coolers as you did in the main event on Sunday. Are you also going to play the 25K high roller?
Yes, I'm scheduled to play in it also.
Well, you got a very, very busy week. We'll get updates on all of that when we see you back here at Harrah's next week.
Okay. Thank you, Paul, for covering for me a little bit.
Oh, you're very welcome. There's my partner, Dennis Phillips, live from Monte Carlo, where he's playing in the European Poker Tour finale. I'm Paul Harrah, sitting here in St. Louis in the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis. We'll take a break, and when I come back, I'll be joined by Paul Wasika, the man who was the runner-up in the World Series of Poker main event in 2006 and was just here for the circuit event about a week and a half ago. As the final table continues on Five Night of the Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcasts on thechipleader.com.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is the Final Table, the only show in St. Louis with a poker millionaire. That's Dennis Phillips and his co-host Paul Harris on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Dennis is still off in Monte Carlo at the EPT finale. Before I introduce our guest, I was mentioning right before the break some legal stuff and the fact that we are sponsored by the Poker Players Alliance. That's the group that you should be a member of, just like us, to help support legalized poker in every form, from online to brick-and-mortar casinos like Harrah's St. Louis, to home games, to everywhere else. It's a nonprofit membership organization that lobbies and fights for poker players just like you. Go to thePPA.org, that's thePPA.org, and become a member today of the Poker Players Alliance. Our guest today at the final table is Paul Wasika, a.k.a. Quickfish. Paul got known to a lot of people 4 years ago when he was the runner-up to Jamie Gold at the World Series of Poker main event. The following year, racked up a win at the NBC National Heads Up Poker Championship. He's cashed in four other World Series of Poker events and four WPT events. Earlier this year, he started off his 2010 by winning the World Series of Poker circuit event in Tunica. And then I ran into him just about a week and a half ago when Harrah's St. Louis was host to his first ever World Series of Poker circuit event. And now I'm happy to welcome him to the final table. Hi, Paul. How are you today?
Hey, doing well. Thanks for having me, Paul.
Oh, it's a pleasure talking to you. Do you go to these circuit events because you're trying to rack up Player of the Year points?
No. I mean, that really has little bearing on my decision. Basically, 2010, I decided to rededicate myself to poker And so it was just a way for me to sharpen up my skills. You know, I felt like I had only been playing, you know, one, maybe two main events a month before then, and I really wanted to just get back into the swing of things and become the best poker player I could be. So, you know, player of the year, you know, if it comes, it comes. If it doesn't, whatever. But for me personally, it's more wanting to develop my game and work on all weaknesses of my game and just get back into the swing of things.
So after Tunica and St. Louis, are you planning on doing a lot of other circuit events and other tournaments that aren't World Series related around the country?
Yeah, I mean, for a while I had, you know, a thing where I was just not really doing well in shorter stack tournaments where they don't give you as many chips to play. But, you know, I've worked on that aspect of my game, the shorter stack play and being a little bit more patient and not spewing off so many chips early on. So, you know, it's a good way for me to try out different structures and still play live, because I think that's become a big strength of mine is playing more live events. So, you know, the buy-in to me doesn't really matter as much as just, you know, getting back on my game and getting my reads down and just having fun, really.
Yeah. Did you have fun with the structures that Jimmy Sommerfeld and his crew had set up for these?
Yeah, I think they've done a really good job. You know, the Tunica and the St. Louis events, I think, had the same structure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's definitely very slow-moving at first. But, you know, I think that gives you a chance to capitalize on some of the mistakes that people are making early on. A lot of players lack the patience early on and are trying to force some of the moves, sometimes myself included. but yeah, I mean, ultimately, when it came down to it, I thought that the structures in both events were very good.
Yeah, I like them, too, because it's, you know, I'm a deep cash game player, and to me, that's what these tournaments are like.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think that it just depends. When I went and played, you know, the San Diego event, they didn't have the same structure out there, so I don't know what their plan is, if they're planning on implementing this structure in all the WSOP circuit events or what, but I think that team does a really good job. I've played a few of the circuit events so far this year. You know, there was one up in Atlantic City that they're running as well, and that team's doing a really good job.
Yeah, I emailed Jack Effel, who's the tournament director overall for the World Series of Poker, and said, I love Jimmy's structure. You should use him everywhere, and hopefully he will. You played, before the main event here in St. Louis, you played in the 1K, which had, I think, 280 people in it, which we thought of as a terrific turnout, and you ended up 14th, so you cashed in that event. And then I was reading a little bit about you online, and you're quoted as saying this, I like players who have styles similar to mine. Phil Hellmuth, Patrick Antonius, J.C. Tran, Phil Ivey, Nam Lee, John Juwanda. Now, John Juwanda and Patrick Antonius, Phil Hellmuth and J.C. Tran, these don't seem to me to be kind of the kind of guys who have the same style. So what are you talking about, Paul?
Well, I guess I should rephrase and say aspects of their game that are similar to mine. You know, a lot of those players are players that I respect very highly in the poker world. And I've basically taken a lot of different parts of their game that I really like and implemented into mine. So, you know, a lot of those players do have different styles, and it kind of sounds a little bit weird coming off that way. But what I meant to say was, you know, aspects of their game that I take and I kind of use whenever I play with a player that I respect highly, whether it's their results or just at the table, their presence. You know, I try to take just a little bit from each player that I respect, and then I kind of incorporate it into my own style. And so that's more what I was getting at in that little quote there.
I think that's a great thing for people to look at and say, I'm not going to play just like Paul Wasica or Tom Dwan or Phil Ivey or Phil Hellmuth or whoever it is. You want to watch what they do and adapt all of those and develop your own style, which could be an amalgam of all of those, just like you've done.
Exactly. You know, I think that it's easy to find a player that you really like and this and that, but sometimes they are doing things that you're uncomfortable doing. And ultimately, if you're not comfortable doing it at the table, it's not going to succeed. You know, so every player has to find what they're comfortable with. And, you know, so sometimes you can like look at a player and you can be like, wow, they're really doing this well. And then you try to emulate that and then you're just not executing it the same. So, you know, it's really important to recognize those differences and just experiment, but at the same time know when things, you know, you should go back to what's been working for you.
Talking with Paul Wasaga here at the Final Table. When I mentioned that you were going to be on, I promoted it on last week's show, and I got a couple of emails from listeners who had questions for you. So I'll hit you with one from Jason, who says he actually played with you in the main event here in St. Louis, and he was wondered if you were distracted by people who recognize you and are coming up to you during an event like that.
Yeah, it definitely is distracting. You know, I definitely try to, you know, be open to any players that want to come up and ask me questions and just come and shake my hand. But at the same time, I get easily distracted enough as is. So, you know, it's definitely something where it's tough to deal with, you know, the bridge of playing your best, but at the same time, you know, not burning any bridges. But you know, in that specific tournament, I was actually pretty disappointed with how I played in the main event. I didn't really think that I did anything terrible, but just I kind of just didn't get anything going, and you know, it was obvious to Jason at least and myself. So, but you know, it's something that, you know, you have to deal with on a regular basis, and so you can't really make excuses. You just have to find, you know, whatever solution you can that will help with that. And you know, a big thing that I've been working with my mindset coach, Sam Shahan, is different ways to prevent me from getting distracted.
Is it tough to avoid the distractions, particularly when you're traveling around and you're playing in different venues? I mean, here we were playing in the middle of the casino. There were all sorts of distractions around from not only the crowd, but people who are playing regular table games not far away. How do you deal with that as you go from venue to venue around the country?
You know, it's difficult, especially when you don't really have, like, I've never been to Harris St. Louis before, so I didn't really know what to expect going in there. And, you know, the tournament area was situated, like, right in the middle of the casino, so it was kind of a difficult circumstance to deal with. But, you know, you have to deal with all that stuff as it comes up.
Yep.
You know, like, each venue, as you said, is completely different. Sometimes you get your own private, like, convention center. Other times you're in the middle of, you know, the slots. But, you know, ultimately you can't let anything get in between you and what you want to accomplish. So, you know, I might suggest to other players that are traveling around, get in a few days early and know what to expect before you get there rather than flying in just for the main event.
I find that I concentrate better the more chips I have, don't you?
I mean, it depends. I used to feel that way, but, you know, I've really made it a point to work on a lot of the weaknesses in my game. So I'm really comfortable at any stage, whether I'm short stack, large stack, medium stack. Obviously, the big stack is a lot more fun to play. You know, it's a lot more easy to make mistakes as well, because you are more in a gambling mood. So you're just picking which pots to go after can be difficult, especially with all the distractions around. But, you know, honestly, you know, it's something that you get used to being on the road. The biggest thing that I combat is just thoughts of wanting to get home, you know, being homesick when you're on the road so much.
Yep.
That's kind of the biggest thing that I battle with personally.
All right, another listener question. David wants to know, in tournaments, should I always raise by the same multiple? Should I always raise 3 times the big blind? Or if I do 2.5 times the big blind, should I always do that as the tournament goes along? Should I keep it the same multiple?
You know, it's tough for me to say black and white, yes, you should, no, you shouldn't. I would suggest, yes, that you should stay with that same opening raise, until you get more comfortable at the tables. Once you're pretty comfortable at the tables, then I just do whatever feels right. So I do vary up my opening raises at times. Sometimes I go back to just doing the same. It goes back to just whatever is comfortable for you at the table. You know, if you're worried that people are picking up tells on you, like when you're raising this much, you know, if you have this kind of hand or whatever, then you might want to go back to the standard. But, you know, if you're able to make differing opening raises with different purposes behind each open, and you feel like you're mixing up so well that nobody really knows what you have when you're raising, you know, just the minimum amount, 2 big blinds, or, you know, when you're raising a little bit more. So, you know, personally, I've kind of gone through both methods, and I implement them both. You know, it's kind of like what I was saying before. You want to create your game rather than being told this is what to do. Because if you're always told this is what to do, then you're always going to be, you know, one step behind, you know, everyone else who's going out and pioneering new ways to play hands and new methods.
Talking with Paul Wasika here at the Final Table. Paul, in addition to his tournament success and his millions in winnings, is also an instructor at the World Series of Poker Academy, and I understand you're writing a book.
Yes, I'm writing a book right now. Actually, I was writing before you called, and it's going to be a heads-up book. You know, I'm quite the procrastinator, so it was actually supposed to come out, I don't know, probably like 9 months ago or so, but I'm really cracking down on it this month. I got my traveling out of the way in early 2010. I've got my game to the point where, you know, I'm going deep in a lot of tournaments, and I'm back. You know, I've got a lot of confidence in my reads, in my play, and so now it's just cranking out this book before the World Series. So that's basically what I'm spending most of my days doing, and you know, I'm having fun doing it too. You know, at first I was a little hesitant to write a heads-up book because, you know, I do feel like there are probably more qualified players out there to write a heads-up book that play it every day. You know, I had that success in 2007, but honestly, before then I had played very little to no heads-up, and so it was kind of, you know, it was exciting and everything to win the tournament, but at the same time, I don't really feel like I'm the person most qualified to write, you know, one of these books. But, you know, I have played more and more heads-up, and I am starting to visualize a lot more of the concepts, and so the book's becoming easier and easier to write. You know, it's definitely a unique game that I highly suggest people try, because I think that it will help out not only their end game, you know, when they get to the final table of a tournament, but also it just helps out with the patience aspect when you are at a ring game. You know how to adjust your hand ranges a little bit more when, you know, if you lose a few players at the table, or when it gets down to blind versus blind. It helps out a lot, too.
Paul is associated with Victory Poker, along with Lee Markholt, who's got tremendous tournament success of his own, and Antonio Esfandiari. And I understand you're doing some charity work. What's this deal for the Kidney Foundation you're doing?
Well, Jennifer Harmon puts on a tournament for charity. I mean, she probably puts on many, but this tournament coming up is going to be in Reno. Mm-hmm. It's going to be May 8th, I believe, mm-hmm. Which is a Saturday, and I'm flying into town a couple days before then. There's going to be a golf benefit also. It's all going to benefit the National Kidney Foundation.
Yep.
And, yeah, there's going to be a lot of pros and celebrities there. So if you're around the area or you want to make a trip down there, so it's my first time attending this event, but it probably won't be the last. You know, I think it's great. Any sort of poker events for charity, I think that anytime we as poker players can give back to the community is great, because it helps justify, you know, being poker players in general.
We had Jen Harmon on the show about 3 weeks ago, and she was talking about this event at the Peppermill Reno coming up in just a couple of weeks, and we'll put a link to it on thechipleader.com for people who are in that area and download our podcast and might want to show up for that. What are your plans for this year's series? How many events do you think you'll play?
Well, typically in past series and poker in general, I've found myself getting burnt out very easily. I go in with these, you know, amazing plans. I'm going to play, you know, 30 events or, you know, whatever. And then I get there and, you know, the summer grind kind of wears on me. And then I end up only playing, you know, 7 to 9 events. And that's typically been what's happened in the past. But, you know, I'm going in with a new rededicated passion for 2010. And, you know, I have Sam in my corner who helps me, you know, get me motivated, play my best, you know, all that. So, you know, I'm really planning on playing more events this year than I ever have. But, you know, like I said, it's easy to go in with a certain plan, and then, you know, if you're not feeling it, it's better to lay off than to force the issue. So, you know, I'm going in with these plans, but, you know, I might end up doing what I have done in the past, but, you know, something tells me that this year I'm going to be very, very excited to be out there. And traveling around and just all the stress of, you know, buying plane tickets and hotel rooms and all that stuff has made it to where this summer when I'm back and I have my home and everything, it'll just be a little bit less stressful to have to worry about travel arrangements and stuff. So hopefully that'll help me keep things in mind that I don't have it quite so bad. Plus, I get to play poker for a living. So
yeah.
Sam helps me keep everything in perspective and you know, I can't say enough about how much he's done for my game, both on and off the table. But, you know, I think that this summer, you know, I don't have a bracelet yet. So, you know, as the motto for the WSOP circuit goes, first the ring, then the bracelet. So, you know, this summer hopefully will be my summer.
Well, we'll see you out there, because not only will Dennis and I be playing, but we'll also be doing the show out there. Maybe we can get together again, and we'll be the visiting team, and you'll be the home team.
That sounds good.
I appreciate your time today, Paul. Thanks very much.
All right, thanks for having me.
That's Paul Wasicka. You can follow him on Twitter as Quickfish with a K, K-W-I-C-K-F-I-S-H, and his website is quickfish.com. This portion of the show brought to you by our home casino, which is Harrah's St. Louis, which this Thursday night is doing a big event for all Parrot heads. Jimmy Buffett's going to be at the Verizon Amphitheater, which is right next door to Harrah's St. Louis. And the Voodoo Lounge will be open before and after the show with a group called the Finns, who will be doing all your favorite Buffett tunes. Starting at 5:30 in the afternoon, you come over here, you do that, you hang out, you hear the songs, then you go see Jimmy do them, and then you come back and you continue the Parrot Head party until a little bit after midnight that night. Also, while you're here, you may want to stop in and get some great Italian food from Charlie Gito's, which has a special going on again tomorrow night, the Wednesday night April special, succulent grilled center-cut beef tenderloin, topped with a family recipe of sautéed mushrooms and a beef and butter sauce. The all-in dinner comes with a twice-baked potato and baked cauliflower, a mixed green salad, spumoni for dessert, all of that for $19.95. That's a great steak dinner from Charlie Gito's, one of the great restaurants here at Harrah's St. Louis. We're all out of time today. I'm sorry I didn't get to give you the one-on-one stuff with Joe McGowan and Andy Block and Gus Hansen. We'll try to get to that on a future show, and if we can't do that, we'll put it up as a bonus podcast for you on our website, thechipleader.com. By the way, you should visit that website and check out our Final Table merchandise, which is for sale now. You can buy a sweatshirt just like the Final Table sweatshirt I'm wearing now, or hats, or T-shirts, or long-sleeve tees for those cold poker rooms, all available right now in when you click the shop button on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. Next Tuesday, he'll be back from Europe, and we'll be back together again here at Harrah's St. Louis. I hope you'll be here, too, on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.